Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Muslim South Asia is widely characterized as a culture that idealizes female anonymity. Women's bodies are veiled and their voices silenced. Challenging these perceptions, Siobhan Lambert Hurley highlights an elusive strand of autobiographical writing dating back several centuries that offers a new lens through which to study notions of selfhood. In Elusive Lives, Gender, Autobiography, and the Self in Muslim South Asia, published with Stanford University Press, she locates the voices of Muslim women who rejected taboos against women speaking out by telling their life stories in written autobiography. To chart patterns across time and space, materials dated from the 16th century to the present are drawn from across South Asia, including present-day India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Lambert Hurley uses many rare autobiographical texts in a wide array of languages to elaborate a theoretical model for gender, autobiography, and the self beyond the usual Euro-American frame. In doing so, she works toward a new globalized history of the field. Ultimately, Elusive Lives points to the sheer diversity of Muslim women's lives and life stories, offering a unique window into a history of the everyday against a backdrop of imperialism, reformism, nationalism, and feminism. In our conversation, we discuss autobiographical writing, travelogues, letters, diaries, interviews, low literacy rates, the social and physical geographies of authors, reasons Muslim women narrate their lives, the role of editors, translators, and publishers, intended and unintended audiences, the actress Begum Khurshid Mirza, and gender differences across autobiographies. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. Now, here's my conversation with Siobhan Lambert Hurley on Elusive Lives, Gender, Autobiography, and the Self in Muslim South Asia. Welcome, Siobhan. Thank you for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks so much for inviting me to participate today.
Yeah, I'm excited about your book, Elusive Lives. It was great to read and, you know, both kind of thorough and engaging, but also just really fun to read it at many parts, very enjoyable. But before we get into the book, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about your background and what brought you to the study of South Asia, the study of Muslims. Were there moments or mentors in your life that kind of shaped the way you approach your topic today?
Thanks for that question. I'll start actually with a story that has been oft told over many years, which is, so I grew up in Western Canada. I was born on Vancouver Island and about as far as you could probably get from India and my subject of study now. And when I was a girl, I was about 9 years old, we did a project at school whereby we were studying countries of the world. And I had an opportunity to get a pen friend somewhere else in the world. And my own family, as my name perhaps suggests, were from Ireland originally. And I thought it would be really fun to find out about my presumed heritage in Ireland. So I asked for an Irish pen friend, and my letter ended up in the wrong I pile, and I ended up with India instead. So it was very serendipitous, I suppose. And I was given the opportunity to write to a girl in Kolkata, or Calcutta, as it still was then. And we continued our correspondence right up until I went to university like a decade later. And because of that long correspondence, I really had a kind of interest when I went to university to study something to do with this place where my pen friend came from, and thus took a few courses as part of a kind of general degree in history and politics at the University of British Columbia. And really my interest was piqued. So I became especially interested in South Asian history, but my undergraduate degree, and I think this is kind of pertinent to this book, my undergraduate degree is actually in South Asian studies. So I had the opportunity as an undergraduate student to study not just history, but also politics and language and anthropology and, of course, literature, which is the subject of this book. And it was also during that time that I really began to kind of gain a fascination with South Asia's Muslim communities, especially. So I often found, you know, when I was doing my reading for my courses as an undergraduate, that there was an awful lot of things that focused on the majority communities within South Asia, but less that looked particularly at women's movements amongst Muslims and the like. So when I ultimately went on to do my PhD studies, which I did at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, I decided I wanted to do something that highlighted the histories of that group that seemed so unrepresented in the historical literature at that time. And that's how I came to work particularly on histories of Muslim women. And actually, I think what you probably see in my career since that time is that kind of that roots in South Asian studies has come out in lots of ways. Most of what I've done over the years has really focused on the kind of historicizing of different types of literary genres. So my first book looked at socio-reformist literature. Of course, I've moved on in this one to look at autobiography. And more recently, I've been looking at travel and food literatures as well. So I think you can see the roots of my past in marked on this book.
That's really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about where the kind of kernel for this book started? When did you start to think about, well, I'm familiar with all this literature and I'm finding all these kind of autobiographical narratives across these various types of texts. I think I can synthesize this in a kind of productive way. When did this kind of emerge as a book in your mind for you?
Yeah, so I mentioned already that my PhD work that ultimately became my first book was looking at socio-religious reform movements, and it was focused specifically on the state of Bhopal in central India, which was a so-called princely state during the colonial period. And what was very distinctive about that state was that it was actually ruled by a dynasty of Muslim female rulers right from the early 19th century up until the early 20th century. And in my research for that book, I was interested particularly in the last of those Muslim female rulers, a woman called Nawab Sultan Jahan Begum of Bhopal. She ruled the state from 1901 through to 1926. And she was very much at the kind of focus of a women's socio-religious reform movement. So she brought together lots of different women within her state who were interested in kind of reforming women's education, reforming women's health initiatives, reforming women's veiling practices and the like. So it was within that context that I obviously started looking in detail at women's writings. But what was also distinctive about that family was that they produced a large number of autobiographical and travel narratives. So I had those kind of as resources for that first book. And I was interested in those texts as documentary sources, I suppose. But as I was kind of reading those texts, I kind of thought that there was more that could be done with them, I suppose. I became interested in how those autobiographical and travel texts could be read to kind of chart changing notions of the self, I suppose, within the period that I was looking at. So I started with this kind of kernel of sources, this body of sources from Bhopal. And I started to think, I'm sure I must be able to find more material like this elsewhere. I mean, you suggested that I kind of started with this large body of material, which actually I didn't at all. I kind of started with a hunch, I suppose. You know, I had these texts from Bhopal and I had a hunch that there must be more. But actually, even when I sort of set out to do my research in India for the first time on this project, I was still kind of thinking, oh God, am I going to find anything at all? Or maybe these texts aren't there to be found. Of course, in time, I was overwhelmed by how much material I came across. So my hunch actually played out, thankfully.
Yeah, I'm glad you pursued it because, it's a great book. And one of the things that I really liked about it, you know, literature isn't my field, but I've read a number of books, and often the kind of approach is let's look at, you know, one or two texts that do similar things and then, you know, move on to, you know, another text. And part of what was really great about yours is you do look at these numerous sources that go across all sorts of different genres. So could you talk a little bit about the types of narratives and texts you ended up selecting? And then in thinking about South Asian Muslim women as a category or as a group of categories, how did that factor into thinking about these texts?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I kind of indicated already that when I started this project, I really wasn't sure what was out there to be found, but I also wasn't quite sure what I was looking for either. You know, I think I sort of started with this kind of inherited notion and very generalized notion probably as well of what autobiography was, or as I came to define it, autobiographical writing. And even, you know, I'm quite conscious, especially in the first chapter of the book, about kind of narrating the process and the thinking processes. And I did that very consciously because I wanted to show that, you know, as historians, we don't start with all the answers, I suppose. We start and we think through, and to show that, you know, this kind of gaining of historical knowledge is a process, I suppose. So in that first chapter, I really seek to kind of narrate how I started with this kind of amorphous idea of what I was looking for, and I slowly narrowed in on it through the process of doing the research. So, you know, first of all, I thought, okay, I mean, in the context of Bhopal, where I started, I had what were pretty well, you know, I think would fit with our kind of notion of what autobiography or memoir was. And then I also had this body of travel narratives. But when I started looking elsewhere, I started to come across kind of a much wider type of source material. You know, very often when I would ask people if they had sources that they could share with me, they would share maybe something we would define more as an autobiographical fragment. So a kind of account of a certain period in somebody's life. Sometimes people handed over to me novels or pieces of poetry. Sometimes they would give me something like an interview, either in a recorded form or in a written down form where it had been, you know, transcribed onto the page. So I started kind of coming across this really wide array of materials. I had one experience in Delhi where I was speaking to a fellow researcher, and she said, "Oh, I'm working with a family up in North Delhi. They have an autobiography that you might be interested in." And when I got there, what I was handed over was about 50 years worth of letters that had been written between a male member of the family and a female member of the family who had migrated to Pakistan in 1947 at the time of partition. And I was kind of confronted with this, you know, boxes and boxes of these letters. And I kind of looked at them and thought, well, is this autobiography? So there was this real kind of conscious process of kind of thinking about what that term meant and what that term meant specifically in South Asia, particularly amongst the subject group I was looking at, that group of South Asian Muslim women. Ultimately, as you'll know from reading the book, I settled on quite a kind of capacious definition, I think. I settled on the constructed life as it was written down. So as I noted already, I focused on autobiographical writing. And I chose that very specifically. I chose that partly because it allowed me to broaden out what I included within my study. It allowed me to bring in the autobiographical fragments, the travel narratives, the edited letters and edited diary books. But it also allowed me, I think, by maintaining the word autobiography, to link this set of literature that I was finding in South Asia to a kind of a global study of autobiography. So many scholars in South Asia have not felt at ease with the term autobiography. They felt that it's a Western creation, a Western notion, and thus they've sought to use other kind of broader terms, things like personal narratives, or other terms of that sort. But I really wanted to take the material that I was using from South Asia and engage, I think, with that debate over autobiography as a kind of global field. And thus I kind of consciously used the term, or at least a version of the term autobiography in terms of the sources that I was looking at. To go back to your original question, which was kind of asking me about using these multiple sources, I was really conscious when I looked at the historiography that just what you're saying, you know, much of the work that has been done on autobiographies, not just in South Asia, elsewhere as well, often focuses on individual texts and sort of, you know, really pulls those texts apart. But I guess what I was interested to do in this book was, I hope, kind of move beyond the individual texts and instead look at a whole set of texts so that I could really trace patterns across time and space. And I felt like it was only if I could kind of get a broader set of materials that I could start to think about the questions that I seek to answer in this book, which are, you'll know that each chapter is framed by a question. I've suggested already that I start with what, I then move on to who, and then where, and then how, and then why. And as a historian, I hopefully weave when throughout all of those chapters.
Yeah, I thought that was also, I guess, implicit in my comparison, but a useful way of framing it and really kind of synthesizing a lot of this, as opposed to doing just the kind of singular reading. Mm. So as you move on and thinking about who is writing these autobiographical narratives, you first kind of tackle the what you call a literacy conundrum. So can you talk a little bit about how low literacy rates among South Asian women affected who gets to write autobiographies?
Yeah, absolutely. So literacy has been very low amongst the group that I'm looking at right throughout throughout history and indeed up into the contemporary context as well. It's quite difficult to pin down exact figures for literacy, certainly before the colonial period. But we can kind of get a sense of it once we start having, you know, statistics in the census and that from that were produced during the period of the colonial state. We know that, you know, at the start of the 20th century, we're looking at, you know, literally less than 2% of Muslim women who have the skills of reading and writing. And even by independence, we're looking at, you know, less than 10%. The literacy conundrum is that I wanted to look at a type of literary genre, but one that could only be produced by a very small number of women in that society. However, as I seek to point out, actually to prepare, I'll say prepare rather than write an autobiography, what I found was that you needn't have literacy, actually. And this was particularly because in a number of contexts that I was looking at, there was a tradition of dictating to a scribe or something of that sort. So on one hand, I was kind of interested in the growth of literacy and how this enabled more women to write about their lives. On the other hand, I was also capturing that you could still have a kind of autobiographical piece, even if literacy wasn't there, I guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You also, in this chapter on who gets to write autobiographies, kind of offer, I guess, some typologies, so to speak, thinking about how things like class and education and occupation shape the authors of these. So how do these factors, structure who has access to autobiographical writings? Why did these authors end up sharing their life? What was kind of the moments that or the impetus for them to kind of narrate their lives?
Yeah, so in that chapter, as you say, I was interested in thinking about who writes and if there was particular categories that we could identify that enabled us to see who wrote in kind of broad terms. It's perhaps not surprising, as from what we've talked about already, that it was mostly the elite and the educated who did write. Though there are exceptions to that rule, as I probably indicated already. So sometimes less elite women would narrate their stories to others who would write them down for them. So, I'm making a generalization here, but also pointing out that there are exceptions to the rule. One of the things that I'm really interested in this book is the kind of linkages that we find between women, between socio-religious reform movements, which were emerging in South Asia from the 19th century, and also autobiography. So how autobiography, I guess, became a kind of vehicle for different groups within society to make assertions about their identities, and particularly make assertions about their place within a social hierarchy. What I found initially, kind of talking, you mentioned that I'm interested in class in the broadest kind of possible terms. And what became quite obvious was that originally a number of women who wrote belonged to what we might call courtly classes. So belonged to perhaps the princely states that I referred to earlier. And of course, that's where I started. I started with women of the Bhopal court who were writing about their lives. And what was quite interesting, I think, is this kind of pointed me to the fact that these princely classes were undergoing a process of being stripped, I suppose, of their kind of nobility in the period that we're looking at. So the late 19th century was seeing the emergence of new middle-class groups amongst Muslims in a colonial context. And as those new middle-class groups wanted to kind of claim nobility, they were redefining what it meant to be noble in a way that it no longer applied in a way to the traditional noble groups within that society. So I think we can see the way in which, on one hand, autobiography is being used by the kind of traditional nobility, the courtly classes, to say, hey, we still have a claim, if you like, on nobility. And then it was being used at the same time by these new middle classes to assert their claims on a sense of nobility, or as we'd say in South Asia, sharifness or ashraf status. So they're trying to claim that as well. And autobiography kind of becomes the vehicle for that. So I think the fact that we see these kind of linkages between certain groups who are writing autobiography, and that is very much kind of reflection of social changes that are happening within South Asian society at the time. Part of those socio-religious reform movements that I was just speaking about too was to encourage the spread of education amongst women. And it's certainly in the early 20th century that we see the growth of schools for Muslim girls in particular in South Asia. And so in a way, again, it's not surprising, I suppose, that it is those educated women who are writing, because they're charting a change within society. They're charting this growth of education that enabled them to go to school and ultimately enables them to write as well. And once they had literacy, that enabled many women to go into all sorts of new fields that they wouldn't have necessarily had access to before either. So many of those girls, having gone to school, that have been the first generation sometimes of girls to go to school, often used their education, not necessarily for what Muslim reformers thought it would be for, which was to become good wives and mothers, but instead went on to go into different occupations. And hence the kind of third category that I look at in this chapter is looking at occupations. And what I find is that, of course, many of the authors of autobiographical texts had very particular occupations. So we see, as I've indicated already, lots of women associated with courts, so courtly women, also lots of educationalists, which also kind of reflects what I was talking about. And then also women that go into other occupations too. So writers, politicians, and performers. We often get these women who are elite and educated and taking up occupations for the first time. And I think ultimately then they write autobiography because they want to chart the exceptional changes, the exceptional experiences that they have had, often as the kind of first generation of women going into those fields.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You move on to thinking about where autobiography is happening. And you also take this in a very kind of expansive way, which I think worked, you know, thinking about things like region and physical space, but also things like, you know, language choices, religious affiliation, also, you know, cityscapes and how that shapes autobiography. So how do the intersections of the social and physical geography shape how Muslim women narrate their life?
Yeah, I was really, when I started that chapter, I kind of started by thinking about, you know, just physically, which regions do we find these? And could I kind of map, if you like, the text that I had onto a map of South Asia? And I did, you know, I do start by doing a little bit of that and highlighting, you know, particular regions where there is more autobiographies than we find elsewhere. And also, you know, even parts of cities, for instance, where more autobiographies emerge. So one of the case studies I look at in that chapter is the city of Delhi. And as you rightly point out, I do kind of flag how cities become a kind of a location to facilitate autobiographical expression. So a place where more autobiographies emerge and where they kind of offer this kind of cultural leadership, I suppose, to the rest of the country. But I found that, you know, even within cities, there was certain areas where I would find lots of autobiographies by women and others where I would find less. So within the context of Delhi, for instance, I spent a very long time in an area called Nizamuddin, which is around a very famous Sufi shrine. And I spent a lot of time with families in that area, and I was convinced that there must be some kind of autobiographies to emerge from that. And I just simply couldn't find anything. On the other hand, when I went to certain areas like Jamia Nagar, which you know, surrounds a university area in Delhi, the University of Jamia Millia Islamia, I just, every day I was being taken from one family to another and being shown these. So I think in a way we can see through the autobiographical map, as I call it, how many of the kind of social characteristics that I look at in that second chapter kind of were reflected in the map as well. So, you know, I was talking about how many educationalists wrote, and of course, unsurprisingly, therefore, that we find an area around a university as being an area that was more likely to show autobiographical expression. Yeah, I also, as you say, try and kind of expand what I mean by geography and look at other factors too. So look at the impact of sect, for instance. One thing that I'm really keen to trace in the book is how certain smaller sects within Islam in South Asia, so groups like the Suleiman Bora community within Bombay, for instance, again, kind of used autobiography as a way of articulating their distinct community identity. So we end up with far more texts from some of these smaller sects than we do from other groups, for instance. And then also, as you say, just kind of thinking more broadly about questions of language and audience. So thinking about how, if women were writing in different areas of South Asia, that local or regional or national context shaped the way they wrote, the language in which they wrote, and the kind of considerations, I suppose, shaped the considerations of what they wanted to include within their text and what they wanted to include in terms of how they constructed their life.
You also touch upon audience in this chapter. So can you tell us a little bit about how intended or unintended readership shape how Muslim women crafted their autobiographical output?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, this is something I'm really interested in the book. in that I think, you know, when people read autobiography, they see it as an expression of self, and they see it as a kind of narration of the self, I suppose. And what I was interested especially was actually how that self was crafted kind of in relationship to another. So in relationship to the reader itself, so that actually it's the context and the readership almost that can craft a narrative as much as the individual author, I suppose. So yeah, I really was interested in the impact of audience. And what's what was really clear to me in looking at kind of wide range of materials that I did is that they all had very different audiences. You know, some of the texts that I looked at were quite consciously written for maybe a singular audience. So one text that I looked at was a memoir written by a woman called Safia Jabir Ali, who from Bombay. And she started writing down her life story primarily to be read by her son. So she wanted her son to have a kind of record of the challenges and experiences that she and her husband had, first of all, as they set up a farm, and also as they became involved in the nationalist movement in India in the early part of the 20th century. So we go from an audience of one up to books, of course, that were published, you know, with big presses with the intention of being read kind of far and wide. And then, of course, we've got everything in between. So some of these texts were written very consciously for kind of extended family audiences. So certain Muslim families or khandans, or clans had would keep maybe family journals and the like, where women would contribute their writings. And you know, you asked about kind of the impact of audience on the crafting of these stories. You can imagine if you're who you're writing for is going to really shape what you write and also what you leave out as well. So for many of these women, when they were writing maybe for a family audience, there was a lot of assumed knowledge because they shared the same kind of cultural milieu. So a lot of things they just kind of left out because they knew their audience would know the context in which they were talking about. And then they also would consciously leave things out because maybe they didn't want to feel that was, you know, they didn't feel that was information that was appropriate to share maybe with elders in the family or the like. So, depending on the audience, we see very different kinds of materials. One thing I'm also interested in is how particularly these Muslim women that I'm focusing on, they very often have a consciousness of writing for women like themselves. So very often they wrote for other women who were also perhaps living quite segregated lives. And because they were writing as they saw it for other women, they often shared aspects of their lives that they thought was kind of appropriate for that all female milieu in a way. So one thing that's quite revealing, which I touch on the book and I've written about elsewhere as well, is that very often these women are very forthcoming to talk about sexuality and intimacy within their lives, because they felt that this was, you know, an appropriate topic that they could discuss with other women. And it's only women who feel like they're writing maybe through a press for a more mixed audience that they don't talk about these kinds of subjects because they don't think it's appropriate to be to perhaps be engaged with by a male audience. So very interesting, I think, about how people imagined their audiences and therefore how they crafted their writing to fit with who they imagined that audience to be.
Yeah, you pick up this dynamic well. you in the following chapter, you look at the how, and there you kind of zoom in on the processes of production and how that might affect autobiographical practice. So what interests might editors, translators, publishers have in autobiographies, and then how might that affect the framing of the subject's narrative?
Yeah, so I mean, I talked about already, didn't I, how I'm trying to kind of show in this book how, you know, autobiography isn't just a narration of the self, it's also a self that is expressed through engagement with others. That other might be the audience, as I've just talked about, but that other might also be all these other kind of players who help construct an autobiography. So in that chapter that you've just referred to, I look at what I think is a really fascinating case study. I was given access to four iterations of the autobiography of one woman, a woman called Begum Khurshid Mirza. And I was given not only her original manuscript, but also a version that was published in a local journal, and then two later book editions. And all four editions of these of her life were subtly different. And that gave me really a chance to kind of unpick the impact of all these players, as I kind of refer to them, the impact of publishers, the impact of editors, the impact of ghostwriters and family members who are writing things in the background, and the impact of you know, designers and publishers as well. So to show how that's been crafted. You note about the kind of interest of publishers in these texts. I think one thing that's really we've seen in the kind of later part of the 20th century and certainly into the 21st century is that autobiography is very often seen as a kind of appropriate mode for women and especially Muslim women to write in. So we can see, you know, one of the things that I kind of came across as I was writing this was the way in which some of the women who wrote autobiographical texts hadn't wanted to write an autobiographical text initially. They had intended to write a kind of maybe a political study of a place or a period, but they were often kind of encouraged or pushed by publishers to take on a kind of more autobiographical mode and to tell their story in that way. So I think that's quite interesting because it sort of shows how autobiography as a sort of set or a group of texts is actually being kind of crafted, I suppose, by the expectations of the publishing industry. And I think that's a point, you know, I've drawn it out in the context of the contemporary, but I think that's was equally true in the kind of late 19th and early 20th century too. There were sort of expectations of what an autobiography should look like, particularly if it was by a Muslim woman, and therefore the kind of editing process almost encourage those texts to fit within a kind of mode of writing or a set of texts.
The last full chapter that you have is really, really engaging. This would work great for folks if they needed something to add to a course as a standalone chapter. But there you kind of basically take like a case study to examine this idea that there is some the gender difference in autobiography, I found this chapter really fascinating. So can you kind of walk us through what this case study is, the kind of various sources you had at your disposal, and then what you found in relation to this idea of gender difference?
Yeah, so I think this might be my favorite chapter too, actually. I loved writing this chapter, and I really think in some ways The other chapters in the book are all kind of almost leading up to this one, kind of laying the ground for what, you know, for this chapter, which I think really gets kind of at the heart of what I wanted to do in this book, which, as you said, is to gender autobiography, to sort of think about the gender differences within autobiography, but also to historicize it. So to show not just how men and women are writing differently, but also how that balance is changing, I suppose, over time. And I guess that's the contribution that I make as a historian to studying literature in particular. In this chapter, I focus on one particular family or khandan or clan within the South Asian Muslim community. And it's a family which is usually known as the Payabji clan. They belonged, as I was sort of pointing out before, to a particular sect within Bombay called the Sulaimani Bora community. And that makes them quite unique and quite exceptional in some ways. But I felt like that was okay in this chapter, because actually what I wanted to do was to make sure I kind of had a case study that was operating within a kind of fixed cultural milieu in a way. So the fact that they were a little bit set apart, they were a little bit different and exceptional, kind of worked for what I wanted to do here. So I mentioned already that in the first chapter, I kind of talk about the process by which I do this research. And this was research that, you know, I didn't just kind of go to an archive and sit down and find all the books I was looking for in the way that maybe we idealize what we do as historians. Rather, I talk about in that first chapter how I used the home, the market, the street as my archive, and how many of the sources I use in this book came from private collections. They came from individual families who were generous enough to share their family's writings with me. And one family who were particularly forthcoming were indeed the Tayabji clan. So I met one member of the family in Delhi, and she shared some materials with me. And then she sent me to another member of the family in Bombay, who shared a few more things with me. And they sent me to another member of the family who sent, shared still more things. And so the process kind of continued. And what I found by the end of that research process was that I had this amazing set of autobiographical writings. And I, again, use that in a very broad term, as a very broad term, to include a number of different types of texts. But I had a set of materials that were written both by men and women within the family, and they dated right from the late 19th century right up to the present day. So it really offered me a kind of chance to think, okay, I've got this set of materials all from one family, all from kind of within a shared cultural milieu. What did they tell us about how men and women write, and how autobiography is evolving as a literary genre within the modern period. And that really offered me an opportunity, I think, to take some of those, I guess, kind of theoretical frames that had been evolved in other contexts, particularly kind of Euro-American contexts, where very often a so-called difference model has been evolved. So to suggest that men and women write very differently, and to kind of apply that to the South Asian context, and apply it in a way that I could both challenge it and also hopefully extend it. So to develop a kind of new model, I hope, that would also apply to the South Asian Muslim case. And what came out very strongly is that, the difference model just didn't work, or it didn't work in the way that maybe people might expect it to, once I was looking at this kind of case study of the Tayabji clan. I found, you know, one of the things that has been posited by the difference model, and I'm summarizing in a very simple way here, but, you know, it's been pointed out that women write about the domestic while men write about the public. in fact, what I found by kind of comparing these texts over a long period is that, yes, women did write about the domestic, and perhaps that was unsurprising because their world was framed by the domestic environment. But the men in the family were just as likely to talk about their families and their personal relationships and that as well. So there was a lot of kind of crossover in these terms. I kind of go on from there.
There's a lot in the book, and obviously we didn't get to cover anything, but is there anything you wanted to discuss before we wrap things up?
I guess maybe one last thing I just wanted to kind of highlight is that, I think there's been this kind of assumption for a long time that autobiography is very much something that is identified with the West. In a lot of the kind of literature that you see, this was much more a feature of the late 19th and early 20th century, but the implication kind of still finds its way, I think, into kind of more recent theoretical writing too, is that, that autobiography belongs to the West. and I hope this book will really kind of challenge that portrayal by showing that, that we have these really amazing and fascinating texts that are written by South Asian Muslim women. And I think, I hope too, that it will challenge many of the kind of preconceptions that people have of South Asian Muslim women too, as being kind of silenced and secluded. Because here we have a source that enables us to kind of get beyond those preconceptions and really see my subjects as the varied and colorful people that they were.
That's great. Now, we'd love to hear more about the things you've been working on since the book, and perhaps something we can look forward to that might be coming out in the near future.
Well, thank you for giving me that opportunity. I'm thrilled to say that a kind of next project after this book was actually a much bigger collaborative project that I did with two other scholars, Daniel Makovitz and Sunil Sharma, which took kind of one set of the materials that I was looking at here and explored it in much more detail. So I've been working on a project since this book, which looks particularly at travel writing by Muslim women. And it doesn't focus just on South Asia. It also looks at other areas of the Muslim world too. Again, it's about historicizing the literary genre. It's about looking at how travelogues have emerged and changed from about the 16th century up to the present, right across the Muslim world. And that collection, which includes a lot of translations as well from different languages, is just about to come out as another book, which is called Three Centuries of Travel Writing by Muslim Women. That'll be out with Indiana University Press in 2022. And since then, I'm also working on a new project, which again is kind of a spin-off, I suppose, of this book. One thing that really came true to me when I was working on this, on these autobiographical materials, is how women spent an awful lot of time writing about food. And I became very interested in how they were charting kind of changes in terms of eating and food etiquette in the modern period. So currently I'm working on a new project, which looks particularly at that eating and etiquette in Muslim South Asia.
Wow. Well, congrats on the forthcoming book and good luck on the next one. Sounds like a yummy project to work on, and probably makes you want to eat a lot of food while you're writing it. So
absolutely.
Well, thanks again for making the time to talk about this wonderful book, and good luck on the next one.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Siobhan Lambert-Hurley on her book, Elusive Lives, Gender, Autobiography, and the Self in Muslim South Asia, published with Stanford University Press in 2018. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.